Well, good morning, Per Fagren, KBOO News and Public Affairs, and our guest is Antonia Juhas, who has written a book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. Antonia, welcome once again to KBOO.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Well, you know, going from the title of your book to what's happening in Iraq, I get the impression that the U.S. May be losing the war, but still trying to gain the spoils.
Yeah, losing the fight but winning the war might be some of the ways of looking at it. What I detail in the book, and maybe a place to back up a little bit, is that my work has been in policy analysis and as an activist, and I'm currently a visiting scholar with a group called the Institute for Policy Studies based in Washington, D.C., but I'm also an activist with a group called Direct Action to Stop the War. And in our work leading up to the war, we realized that there were key corporations that were aggressively guiding and influencing the decision to invade Iraq, and were definitely setting themselves up to be those who would take advantage of the invasion of Iraq, and began to look more and more closely at the economic agenda of the administration in Iraq. And in doing that work and in participating in our activism against the war, I realized that those connections and that agenda ran very deep, and that I needed to do more than write handouts for our actions and information on our website, but needed to take a year and research those connections. And that's the genesis of what has become this book. And as you say, you know, my conclusion is that the administration has done an extremely good job of transforming the economic infrastructure of Iraq to support most importantly, in their mind, the transformation of the oil sector. And that transformation is underway and moving in the direction that they would hope, which is to open Iraq's oil sector to private foreign corporate investment, and it's U.S. companies and a few British ones that are lined up to take advantage of those contracts. And I argue that, you know, unless we have quite a bit to do about it, the U.S. military and most likely the British military will not leave Iraq until that oil timeline is complete.
Well, you kind of go back to Paul Bremer, you know, who is the sort of the proconsul of the empire there, and he promulgated these 100 orders that sort of turned the Iraq's economy upside down, and they are still in effect, right?
That's right. So I detail in the book the 100 orders that Paul Bremer put in place. Paul Bremer was the administrator of the U.S. occupation government of Iraq, the Coalition Provisional Authority, for 14 months. And during that time, he put in place the economic transformation of the Iraqi economy that actually had been prepared quite earlier. It's a real misstatement and, in fact, a lie to say that there was no post-invasion plan for Iraq. In fact, the Bush administration had a very clear plan, an economic plan, and it was prepared by a company called Bearing Point, based in Virginia, that 2 months prior to the invasion of Iraq had created a plan for the economic reconstruction of the country. Bearing Point received a $250 million contract to write out that reconstruction plan, and then Paul Bremer put it in place on the ground in Iraq with exactly 100 orders. And those orders were then locked in by the new constitution of Iraq, so essentially all of them, except for about three, are still in place and locked in Iraq.
Well, could you say then that their plan, they had their economy, their economic grab planned ahead of time, but they didn't foresee the actual rebellion that would occur in Iraq?
Well, I mean, there's two things. First of all, the economic plan, from a Bush administration perspective, is being successful. So Iraq's economy now does several things. For one thing, it has a national treatment provision, which has allowed national treatment means that the Iraqis cannot give preference to Iraqi companies or Iraqi workers under any situation, and in particular in the reconstruction. That has allowed for 150 U.S. corporations to receive some $50 billion in reconstruction money, allowing them to go to work in Iraq, allowing them to hire outside employees and not have to hire Iraqi employees, and to utterly fail at their work, because most of them have what's called cost-plus contracts, which means that they're guaranteed their costs plus a fixed fee in return. So no matter how much they spend and how much they fail, they're guaranteed that money back plus their fixed fee. And most of them, many of them, have failed miserably and horribly in their work, helping to lead to the insurgency, as you say, which was unexpected. I think that the administration knew that it wasn't going to be quite the cakewalk that they had tried to sell to the American public, but they definitely did not expect, I do not believe, the power of the Iraqi resistance. And what that has done has really slowed down the implementation of the full economic agenda, because they definitely thought, you know, I think that U.S. companies would be, you know, set up in place for the long term in Iraq by this point, and more importantly, U.S. oil companies. What the insurgency has done is forced the Bush administration to spend a lot more time slowly and painstakingly putting together a government that not only serves Bush administration interests, but also, you know, unfortunately from their perspective, has to reflect Iraqi interests as well, and that has definitely slowed down their plan.
You know, I read just recently that Iran has offered to help rebuild Iraq.
The Iranians have contributed money to Shia areas in Iraq, and have most recently donated, I think it was $100 million, and they're definitely assisting. They have very close ties to key members of the new Iraqi government. However, you know, the Bush administration wasn't unaware that that connection would happen, but it also turns out that the Shia, you know, have also been willing to play ball in three very key areas. They're the Shia who make up the current government, as do the Sunnis and Kurds who make up the current government. The key leaders of that government have three very important things in common from the perspective of the Bush administration. One, they support the occupation of Iraq by the U.S. military. Two, they support the economic transformation that's underway by the Bush administration. And three, they support the restructuring of the Iraqi oil economy, which is also currently underway by the Bush administration. Now, they disagree with the Bush administration on lots of other things. Some things that the Bush administration told us were very important to them, such as, oh, the status of women or human rights or the role of religion in the political life of Iraq. All of those things the Bush administration seems to have been willing to push aside to lock in its economic agenda.
Well, I think we could have predicted that.
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we did. Most of us did.
Uh-huh. So what you're saying now is that all three, now the president, vice president, and the Talibani from Kurdistan, they all go along with this agenda?
Yeah, they all go along with the agenda because basically what we've got is a, you know, a political struggle within Iraq with parties who want to have as much control of Iraq as possible. And right now the best way to do that is by working with the Americans. Mm-hmm. The best way to do that is to be the favored parties of the Americans and to play ball as much as possible, because these are not people who would be supported, who would be in government if the U.S. military wasn't supporting them. They don't have popular support from the Iraqi public. And that's one of the reasons why we're seeing such intense civil war-like activity taking place across Iraq, because the political leaders aren't the leaders that represent the people. They're the they're the political leaders who represent the administration, Bush administration. And obviously there's intense resistance against that as well. And it's one of the reasons, you know, it empowers us in our argument that the U.S. military is the main reason why the instability in Iraq continues at such a great level, because the U.S. military not only creates a focus for resistance, but the U.S. military supports an unsupported government as well. And it's one of the key reasons why our military needs to leave as quickly as possible.
Well, it seems to me, I don't know, but maybe he's just doing this for public consumption, but the president of Iraq has made noises about, you know, the U.S. troops leaving, especially after some of the atrocities that have been uncovered. Is that just for show, or is he serious?
No, he hasn't done that. He said that he's going to investigate the Marines involved in Haditha. But, of course, U.S. soldiers and U.S. contractors have complete immunity from Iraqi law while they're operating in Iraq. That's thanks to a Bremer Order, number 17. And the Iraqi government has no control over U.S. soldiers whatsoever. He's making statements that he wants them to be investigated, as he should. but he said that he wants a timetable for withdrawal, but that timetable includes some 10 years worth of U.S. occupation and British occupation. And most recently, more U.S. troops have been added. 1,500 U.S. troops have been brought from Kuwait into Iraq. So, you know, I think, yeah, he needs to say words towards the withdrawal of U.S. troops, but he certainly hasn't demonstrated that with action.
Maybe you should point out that, from what I've heard, that Bremer's 100 orders are violate international law. In other words, an occupying power is not allowed to do anything to restructure the economy of the occupied nation.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. One of the things that I discuss in the Bush agenda is how the Bush administration has really turned international law on its head. The Geneva Conventions are very clear, and the UN was very specific that the United States would need to uphold the Geneva Conventions in the occupation of Iraq. An occupying nation has a specific commitment that it must ensure that the basic necessities of life are provided in the occupied country, in the occupied territory. That means water has to flow, electricity must be on, security must be provided, and the like. However, an occupying nation is specifically restricted from altering in any significant way the political or economic laws of the country they're occupying. So the United States has done the exact opposite. By bringing in companies such as San Francisco's Bechtel, California's Parsons, Halliburton, Shaw, Perini, all of these companies that have been given contracts to rebuild electricity, water, sewage systems, those companies utterly failed in those contracts. And one of the main reasons being is that they spent so much time assessing the situation, trying to build the most expensive systems they could, building systems that didn't make any sense in Iraq, that they generated intense opposition to those companies and their presence, so that then they couldn't go to work because it was unsafe. That water, sewage, and electricity are still not even at pre-war levels in Iraq, and of course security is far worse. That the administration has utterly failed to provide for the basic necessities while it has simultaneously completely restructured the entire economic and political infrastructure, and that is utterly against international law and definitely an area, you know, where activists should focus, can focus.
Well, is there any chance that some party may take the U.S. to the international court?
It's certainly possible. I know that there have been some discussions around this area, but very little action. It wouldn't be to the international court. I mean, of course, the United States doesn't abide by the international court. And, you know, there's so many other international crimes that the United States has committed in Iraq that this may not be at the top of the list, but there's been a tremendous process called, what are they called? The oh gosh, I'm forgetting now. The tribunals, international tribunals on mm-hmm. Iraq that have taken place all around the world, and this has been one of the key areas of focus in those tribunals. If people go to my website, which is thebushagenda.org, you'll find a link to the tribunal websites and see more information on this area. I think at this point, one of the most important things we can do to not only end the military war in Iraq, but end the economic and corporate invasion, is look very closely at those companies that are a part of that invasion and expose their role, but also to follow very closely the development of the restructuring of the Iraqi oil sector, because that is not yet complete, and it is still an area where U.S. activists can have a really important impact, most importantly demanding that there be a public debate in Iraq over what happens to its oil infrastructure, not a process that is controlled by U.S. companies, the U.S. government, and the Iraqi government put in place by the American government. And this process is to develop a new Iraqi national oil law, which actually has its roots in the U.S. State Department and in Bearing Points contract, which opens up all of Iraq's undeveloped oil fields. So Iraq has 80 known oil fields. 17 of them are developed. All the rest are not. All of those undeveloped fields would be open to private foreign corporate investment on terms that are highly favorable to the private companies. So I wouldn't necessarily say that, you know, if Iraqis want private companies to come to work in Iraq, that they shouldn't do so. But I do think that the terms of those contracts should reflect much more than they currently do, the economic interests of the Iraqi public. And right now, the model that's being used, the production sharing agreement, is one that highly favors U.S. or foreign companies to the detriment of the Iraqi public. And the companies that are lined up right now are Chevron, Exxon, Marathon, and Conoco. And the four companies, but just by the way, that I focus on in the Bush agenda as the key advocates of that agenda are, of course, Halliburton, but also Bechtel, Braun, and Lockheed Martin. And those are also key companies for activists to look at.
Mm. Well, is this debate going to happen anywhere? Is it happening in Iraq? And they have a parliament, supposedly, or is it going to happen anywhere at all?
Well, there's much more information that is needed to be gotten to the Iraqis, the Iraqi public. There is definitely dissent in the parliament. There has been from the very beginning. The parliament is much closer to an attempt to reflect the interests of the Iraqis. There's a wonderful group in London called Platform, and again, you can link to them by going to my website, thebushagenda.org, because I don't know their website off the top of my head, that is actually in the process right now of helping to develop a website out of Jordan that would be in English and Arabic and would be a running a set of information on what's happening with the negotiations, what's happening with the oil law, what's happening with the oil companies, and that would be a really important resource for Iraqis. But mostly, I think the most important thing that we can do in the United States is demand that the Bush administration make a clear statement, or that our companies make a clear statement, or that our Congress demands of our administration that the U.S. will not guide the development of its oil law. Because that would be, as I said, the ultimate, winning of the war, even if they lose the battle, and the battle is, you know, peace and security in Iraq, mm-hmm. Which seems not very likely to be won.
Well, we're talking to Antonia Juhas, who has written a book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time, and numerous articles. If people want to call in with a question, the number is 231-8187. So let's talk about Adel Abdul Mahdi. You mm-hmm. talked about him before. He's you don't hear too much about him in the in the press, but he's a pretty important guy, isn't he?
Yeah, I actually just wrote a piece for the Huffington Post on Mahdi, where I describe him as Bush's ace in the hole in the new Iraqi government. and I focus on him in great detail in the Bush Agenda. He is someone who is currently one of the vice presidents of the new, now what's called the permanent Iraqi government. And he was, he's been in every essentially Bush administration created government of Iraq since the occupation. When Paul Bremer left Iraq and ended the formal period of occupation, closed down the Coalition Provisional Authority and turned over authority to the interim government of Iraq, Abdel-Mahdi was one of the candidates that the Bush administration was most interested in being the new prime minister of Iraq. Instead, that position went to a former CIA operative, Ayed Alawi, so they weren't too disappointed with that. And Mahdi became finance minister. From that position, he was the person who most aggressively ensured that the Bremer orders would actually be implemented and would continue to be in place as the new Iraqi government took hold. He also took two trips to the United States in which he met with Bush and met with Cheney and gave public presentations where he explained that a new oil law was in the works in Iraq and that it would be, quote, very good for U.S. companies and U.S. oil companies in particular. Mahdi has supported the potential privatization of all of Iraq's state-owned businesses, the 100% foreign ownership of Iraqi businesses, the full repatriation of profits. So not only do U.S. companies get all these contracts in Iraq, but they're not required to invest any of the money in Iraq. All of the money can be sent back and has been to the United States. No profits have to stay in Iraq. He supported this whole transformation. He was then on the top of the Bush administration's list to be the new, now permanent, prime minister of Iraq. And that did not happen, but he did become the new finance minister. And he is someone who is very aggressively supporting the new oil law and the economic transformation and has, as I said, been in every interim government. So I skipped one government. He went from being finance minister to the transitional vice president to now the permanent vice president of Iraq. And he is definitely somebody to keep our eye on. There's also now a brand new oil minister.
I can ask about him. Shah Rastani is his name. Who is he?
That's right. Shah Rastani is a very interesting person. He is a nuclear scientist who in 1978 became the head of Iraq's nuclear science industry or state research facility. Then when Saddam Hussein became president in 1979, Hussein fired and jailed Shah Rastani. There's different stories of why he was jailed, but clearly he didn't support Hussein's activities in the atomic energy field. And he spent 11 years in jail and then escaped during the first U.S. Gulf War and went to Iran, where he set up an Iraqi exile fund that was supported directly by the British. And then went to London. And he is considered a very close ally of al-Sistani, the leading Shia cleric in Iraq, a very committed Shia political figure and religious leader, but not in any way, one of the clear supporters of the U.S. or supporters of any party other than the Shia themselves. And I think he was, the oil ministry was one of the very, very last to be named, one of the most controversial. And I think he was a player that was picked where he would do what was asked of him of the Shia leadership. And I think that that's why he was chosen for that role.
So then he might oppose Mahdi's plans?
Oh, not at all. The Shia leadership supports Mahdi's plan. Mahdi is a member of the Shia leadership.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, what about Iran? Because the Shia leadership, they're sort of supposedly close to Iran, and would Iran allow this to happen?
You know, it's hard to say which allegiance is going to get drawn on first and most aggressively. Right now, their allegiance has to be to the U.S. because the U.S. military is what's supporting them in power. They have longer-term, you know, commitments to Iran, but not necessarily to this president in Iran. And you know, I think right now they're making clear and through the negotiations that, you know, their interest is in maintaining power, and if that means, you know, playing ball with the Bush administration, then that's what they're going to continue doing. And the Bush administration is clear in its negotiations that it is going to stay in Iraq until the oil law is put in place, U.S. companies can sign contracts. They needed a permanent Iraqi government with which to do that, and now they've got that. But once they sign the contracts, they still need some sort of security under which to get to work. And what better security force than 150,000 American troops?
Sort of more or less unwilling American troops, too.
Highly unwilling.
What about Muqtada al-Sadr?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's his role in this? Is he going to go along with this scheme, or is he going to fight against
it? He certainly is not. I think he's made his role pretty clear.
Uh-huh.
I think, you know, what obviously there is tremendous resistance in Iraq, but also the entire last chapter of my book, The Bush Agenda, is about resistance worldwide to this agenda. And, of course, as you alluded to, one of the most powerful voices currently opposing the war in Iraq is the soldiers themselves. And, you know, we've seen there's been five major generals that have emerged in opposition to the war. Those generals are simply reflecting the views of the military itself. A recent poll was taken of U.S. soldiers currently serving in Iraq, which found that a full 70% of them said that they think that the United States has to be out of Iraq in no more than a year, that it's just not working and they need to be out of there. And those soldiers are returning to the United States and organizing in unprecedented numbers against the war. Then in that, they're supported by their families, they're supported by the peace and justice movement, and they have made it, with focusing on counter-recruitment efforts in particular, so that recruitment levels in the United States are at all-time lows. And there's no way that the Bush agenda can move forward militarily if there's no soldiers to fight. And that's an extremely powerful part of the anti-war movement and growing. However, I mean, and that entire chapter is about the positive note. It's about how we're stopping the policies of corporate globalization all around the world, how we're stopping the Bush agenda through in the United States and elsewhere. Chapter 7 of the Bush agenda is about how this economic agenda is spreading throughout the Middle East. So right now, the Bush administration is aggressively negotiating a new free trade agreement called the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area that would spread the economic transformation in place in Iraq to the entire Middle East. And the countries of the Middle East, because they're insulated, I mean, if you think of, say, Central America, South America, Africa, these are very poor regions that have had to succumb to the policies of the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank or the World Trade Organization because, very simply, they've needed the money and they've been forced into these horrible conditions placed on them by the institutions. Well, the Middle East has been largely immune from such policies because of their oil wealth. Well, because of the war in Iraq and the war on terror, the Bush administration has essentially cornered the countries of the Middle East and said, you are in no position to say that you're against the United States. You know what we'll do if you don't play ball, and you need to negotiate these agreements. And they are, in unprecedented numbers, signing the most extreme free trade agreements that any of us have seen anywhere.
What countries are these? Jordan, Egypt?
The Middle East Free Trade Area covers 20 countries in the Middle East. And that's basically every country, even Syria and Iran, are listed by the Bush administration as potential participants. It seems highly unlikely that they would, but it's every country in the Middle East, essentially, including Northern Africa. And the countries that have signed, the Middle East Free Trade Area is a completely unique negotiating structure. Every negotiation is between the United States and one other Middle East country. Then each of those free trade agreements will then be linked together to create a Middle East free trade area. So if you compare that, for example, to the free trade area of the Americas, where Brazil and Venezuela and other countries were able to come together as a bloc and resist the influence of the United States and stop the free trade area of the Americas, that is impossible with the Middle East area, because the countries can't negotiate as blocks. They can only negotiate one-on-one.
I think we had a caller on the line. So
okay.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I've always been curious. What happened to the great bales of cash and gold that were seized from Saddam Hussein? I remember reading about, for instance, a tanker truck that was opened up at some border site, and there were bars of gold and metal inside, and then the U.S. administration later said, oh, that was just shell casings that had been melted down. Don't worry about that. And also, those bales of $100 bills that, you know, I think $9 billion in cash were looted, and I've always wondered what happened to that. And also, is it intentional that the Bush administration is spreading depleted uranium all over the Middle East, or at least all over Iraq currently? And do they know what the ramifications of that is, or are they just too stupid to know what they're doing as far as polluting the land there?
Boy, two good questions. Okay, follow the money and depleted uranium.
Yeah, that's the title of my section in the book that covers the money, Following the Money.
Mm-hmm.
Your question is a very good one. What happened to the money, nobody knows. There was at least $18 billion that was Iraqi money taken from Iraq's oil and, as you said, confiscated money from Saddam Hussein that was part of what was called the Iraqi Development Fund that the U.S., that Paul Bremer took over on behalf of the Coalition Provisional Authority. At least $9 billion of that money is just gone. It's completely unaccounted for. Attempts to track it have revealed, you know, essentially this is how the CIA has always worked in whenever it operates. CIA agents walk around literally with duffel bags full of money that they use to hand out and get what they're trying to accomplish. Well, essentially, the Bush administration was operating like CIA operatives in occupation in the occupied Iraq, and handing out money left and right. Much of it, I'm sure, being stolen, being given as graft, being you know, misused and abused by those who had access to it to try and, you know, pave the way for the Bush agenda in Iraq. We're starting to see, thankfully, many cases emerging of whistleblower cases within companies, U.S. companies that received money from the U.S. government, exposing you know, millions and millions of dollars of essentially stolen Iraqi and American money and taking place during the war. However, one of the things that has happened is in whistleblower cases, there is a provision where a private U.S. citizen or group can sue on behalf of the U.S. government if it believes that a company has defrauded the U.S. government. And there's at least 50 of these cases that are known to be pending. But the problem is these cases can't go forward as long as the Justice Department fails to take a position on the cases. Will the Justice Department participate in the case or not? The Bush administration has essentially stymied all of these cases from going forward by not weighing in on them. So that would be another place where we could see some of what happened to this money. I haven't heard of ships sailing off with the money, but I wouldn't be surprised. I just think there's, you know, it's an incredible case of graft, both within the Iraqi government put in place by the Bush administration and the occupation government of the U.S. And I don't know anything about the uranium, and I would love to learn if you find out.
There's so much information on that, what it does to people, and you know, there are military people coming home with all sorts of dreadful diseases which they pass on to their children, and you know, it's like I think the government is doing its best to sort of keep this under wraps, but it's bound to come out. It is coming out, and it hasn't been a huge issue yet, but I don't see how they can avoid dealing with this. Now, I think the caller was asking, does the Bush administration, do they know about this, or do they know and just don't care?
Of course they know. They're not stupid. The last thing they are is stupid.
So they're willing to sacrifice our own troops.
Boy. Of course. They don't care.
Why?
Yeah.
Well, gee, you know, we talked about counter-recruiting. This is one of my little obsessions. If I had $1 million, I'd print up a whole lot of booklets of General Smedley Butler's book, War is a Racket, and pass those out to at recruiting stations and things like that, because here was a guy who was a genuine Marine Corps hero and retired, and he somewhere in his career realized that he was a sort of a gun thug for the corporations, and he goes into detail. He's in Haiti and Central America. He was in Asia, you know. And people don't know much about him, even though the U.S. military has a base named after him. I think it's on Okinawa or someplace or other. But, you know, I don't know. People really need to know about this guy. And I know I passed out little flyers, you know, where they have I have his picture and his biography on one side, and, you know, pro-war people, you know, they take those and they start reading them, and then they turn it over and they read his a few excerpts from his speech, you know.
That's great. You know, I think one of the things that I have definitely found in all the conversations I've had with U.S. soldiers who have returned from Iraq is their desperate interest in getting more and more and more information, that they realize that they've been sent over there under lies, and that they're eager for books and material and all sorts of information to educate themselves, and that they then take that information and have used it to lead tremendous, as I said, you know, organizing against the war. And I think it's, you know, the immense strength of the peace and justice movement in the United States that, you know, all of these groups have united very successfully in opposition to the war. And I think it's very important for those of us who are activists against the war to highlight that, you know, 70% of the American public now opposes the war. That didn't happen overnight, and it didn't happen mysteriously. It happened because of the ongoing committed activities of people like all of us, raising the questions, demanding the answers, showing that there's an opposition movement, creating a place where the soldiers could come to and organize against the war, and that we have made it so that 70% of the public opposes the war, and we have to continue with that activity to turn that into not just opposition but action against the war.
Yeah, revive the old GI coffee houses, too.
I don't know about GI coffee houses.
Oh, they were back in the Vietnam War, you know, the peace people would set up these coffee houses, you know, near military bases and talk to the GIs who, you know, looking for a place to have a cup of coffee or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you talked about this survey, you know, of the soldiers over there. One thing that seems to be in that survey, yeah, a lot of them wanted to, you know, get back here as soon as possible. But they also, a great majority, seem to believe that Saddam Hussein has something to do with 9/11.
Not anymore. Many of them did, as did much of the American public, you know, most of the American public at the time of the war. And I think that, you know, several things have happened. First of all, many U.S. soldiers have gone to Canada and have gone AWOL to Canada. And I was there, I was in Toronto recently talking about the Bush agenda, and met with many AWOL soldiers. And what most of them say is, you know, many of them signed up after 9/11, believing this connection and believing that they needed to fight and fight in Iraq and fight in Afghanistan, and then realized that that was a myth and that it was false and that they didn't have any recourse and they refused to fight. And many of them have gone, you know, AWOL to Canada. And there's tremendous support networks there that also can use, you know, our help and support. And again, they're connected on my website, The Bush Agenda. In addition, you know, one of the things I think we have to take note of is that in the lead up to the war against Iraq, there was a tremendous groundswell of public belief, U.S. public belief, that we were a danger. The American public, many members of the American public, really bought into the Bush administration lies and believed that we were a danger against Iraq. That is not happening with Iran. The Bush administration is trying to push this exact same model of instilling fear and making Americans think that Iran is ready to nuke us, or will nuke us the second they get the technology. But there is no equivalent uprising in the United States to support that position or feel that fear. And I think that is, again, because of the tremendous work of exposing the lies of the administration such that now the majority of the American public isn't buying it.
Mm-hmm.
And if that keeps us from invading Iran or using covert military activity or more covert military activity than we are already using, that is a tremendous victory that we have to continue to work on and make sure succeeds. No war against Iran is a huge achievement.
All right,
although Iran is certainly something that certainly a place where the Bush administration wants to go and wants to be next.
Well, we are talking to Antonia Juhas, who has written a book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time. In opposition to this this oil law that they're trying to get through, what about the labor unions? I understand they're very much opposed to giving away their country's oil.
Absolutely. And there's a wonderful group, U.S. Labor Against the War, which has worked very closely with, in particular, the oil unions in Iraq. And the oil unions in Iraq are highly organized and highly opposed to any move towards privatization of the Iraqi oil industry or the dramatic opening of the oil industry to the U.S. companies. And what they have called for is, most importantly, what I've said, a true public debate on Iraq's new oil infrastructure and to get the U.S. companies and the U.S. government off their backs so that the negotiation takes place without that outside influence. Right now, as we mentioned earlier, Bering Point's new contract specifically has them working as advisors to the Iraqi government on the new Iraqi oil law. That's a U.S. contract that we can get canceled, that we have to focus on. There's calls from also the Iraqi oil workers that no contract be signed while the occupation continues, and that they are very clear that the military occupation must end. They are working as hard as they can. Unfortunately, and then there's tremendous hope in that. Unfortunately, that shouldn't give us a reason. Many people I've heard in discussions of the economic transformation of Iraq say, the Iraqi people would never stand for it, so therefore, we don't have to worry about it. Well, the history of corporate globalization policy around the world is immense public opposition, but the policies still being enforced because of the interests of key political and corporate leaders. And what we have done everywhere is unite with people's movements to help stop the implementation of corporate globalization policies. The fact that Iraqi oil workers and the people of Iraq oppose this process isn't a guarantee that it won't go forward. And we still, have to support them as much as we can in their opposition. And one of the main ways of doing that, as I said, is just information and sharing information in the United States and elsewhere. And U.S. Labor Against the War is a great resource for more information on what's been happening and is going on with the Iraqi oil workers in particular.
Well, the neoliberal project certainly seems to be falling apart in Latin America.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's the street protests that have done it, and this seems to be, I'm sure people in Iraq and other countries are aware of that.
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. And, that is a movement that is, even while the Bush administration pushes the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area, speaking of that, the latest agreement is the U.S.-Oman Free Trade Agreement, and that agreement is likely going to come before the full Congress just after this recess that they're currently on. And it's very important that members of Congress hear from their constituents in opposition to that agreement. It just expands the same, North American Free Trade Agreement, World Trade Organization, et cetera, policies to the Middle East. And there's lots of information about that agreement on the website of Public Citizen. And there's lots of information about it in my book as well, in the Bush Agenda. But there's much opposition in the Middle East to corporate globalization policy, just as there is in Central America, South America, Africa, everywhere in the United States. But in the Middle East in particular, there's a tremendous lack of information on the negotiations, on the details of the legislation, and you know, the more that we can do to generate and share that information and oppose the agreements when they come before the U.S. Congress, the better.
And the number to call if anybody has a question is 231-8187. You know, it occurs to me, you know, the U.S. can make all these, you know, agreements with politicians and high-level people, but they still got to get the oil out of the ground and home here. And there's so many things that can go wrong.
Sure. And, you know, they have not at all succeeded in this endeavor as they had hoped for. However, they haven't failed as much as they've made it seem either. Prior to the invasion of Iraq, oil production was 2.5 million barrels a day. It currently stands at 2.2 million barrels.
I heard it went down below 2. But
it went down 3.3 million barrels.
Mm.
And that's significant, but it's not nothing.
Right.
And, you know, I think that U.S. oil companies in particular have used the myth of dramatically reduced supply from Iraq to help justify the increased price of gas at the pump. In addition, U.S. oil companies are already marketing tremendous amounts of Iraqi oil, which means that they're already profiting heavily from that oil, and they're getting more contracts than they did before, such that the value of U.S. imports of Iraqi oil have increased 86% between 2003 and 2004 alone. It means that more Iraqi oil is coming to the United States, and of course that oil is worth more because the price of oil has increased so much. So U.S. oil companies are already benefiting from the war, and they're hoping to benefit much more. A great deal could happen to stop that, and it's the entire reason why I wrote the Bush Agenda, is so that this information is available for us to know, you know, how to target our opposition to the war, that the war isn't just about the military invasion. It's about a lot more.
Well, you know, if you look at just the geography of the situation, sort of the larger picture here, that, you know, so much of the oil is in the Middle East and Central Asia, and the U.S. has for the U.S. to get that oil, it has to ship it all the way here. But Russia, China, and all these other countries that are forming this Shanghai Cooperation Organization, they are right there. And these, you know, seems to me that it's a lot. They have much easier access than the U.S. does.
They do have easier access, but don't have the invasion.
Well, how many countries can we invade, though? You know.
No, I know, but I mean, you know, it's the reason for militarily invading, the reason for signing the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area, is to lock in U.S. access, so that the countries of the Middle East don't have the ability to choose and sign more contracts. The process of the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area is an attempt to bust open across the Middle East the energy sector across the Middle East, and they're succeeding. The countries can sign, obviously, contracts with whomever they want, and that's obviously one of the reasons why the Bush administration has been so much more aggressive than previous, than the Clinton administration, and even more aggressive than Bush Sr. and Reagan in trying to lock in guaranteed U.S. access, just for that very reason, because there's lots of, obviously, other people shopping around.
Well, China's locked in some agreements, too, haven't they?
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. No, the United States has not taken over oil in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
But they're trying to.
Right.
And, you know, the more that we can expose that, mm-hmm. the better. Yeah.
Well, it seems like, you know, that, you know, if some kind of a crash, you know, we haven't even talked about the whole dollar question, and, you know, Iran, I guess they are going to open up their oil bourse real soon, and Russia's talking about selling their oil for rubles and their gas for rubles, and it's just, you know, and then there's a whole question of peak oil, which is going to happen sometime, maybe now, maybe later, that is, I get the impression that here's this kind of a, well, as you know, like a big ball is ready to drop or something. It's just,
well, I think we're definitely in a tremendous.
It accounts for sort of the desperation of the Bush people too, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think they see we're at the beginning of a tremendous transformation within the global oil sector, or not. You know, it just depends on who succeeds. The U.S. oil companies have tremendous amount of control over the global oil marketplace, and they want to ensure that that continues. So the 10 largest oil companies in the world, I believe 7 of which or 8 of which are American, produce more oil every day than Saudi Arabia exports. They are also vertically and horizontally integrated, so that the same large U.S. oil companies control exploration, production, marketing, refining, and sales. There was a time when Exxon wasn't connected to Mobil, when Chevron wasn't part of Texaco, wasn't part of Unocal, when we had hundreds and hundreds of oil companies instead of just a few enormous giants. And those giants have tremendous control over how much gas is available at the pump, over where oil is explored for and how, and it's the question of, is that power going to continue to consolidate in those companies, or are essentially the national governments going to reclaim their control more similar to the way it was in the 70s? And that's the battle that's on for the last dribbles of oil, as you say, as we reach peak oil and, you know, we're all downhill from there.
Well, I could just, you know, the U.S. doesn't have enough troops to really pacify Iraq, and I just don't see how they can even dream of pacifying all the other oil-rich countries around the world. It seems.
Well, they don't have to, and that's why the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area is such a concern. They don't have to have troops on the ground everywhere to ensure greater U.S. corporate control of oil. It depends on having friendly governments. So the Saudi government, of course, is very friendly to the United States.
And their position is kind of shaky, too, isn't it?
Right, but it's obviously not at all supportive of its people. And so, you know, it's our job to shake this up even more. and absolutely, you know, ensure that the agenda does crumble and isn't able to succeed. And I think we can do that, definitely.
Well, what do you think would be, well, there's things we can do here, there's things that people can do all around the world. What do you think, how do you see the situation? We have a few minutes left. Do you kind of think there's a lot of hope for this, or what?
In the Bush agenda, I am very clear that it is an activist book, that everything that's happening is our changes and policies that the Bush administration is trying to put in place, that's trying to lock in before they are out of power, that we have succeeded in stopping before and can continue to succeed in stopping before. And what I point to the most is our pre-existing social movements and organizing taking place, that took place to oppose Bush previously, that took place to oppose the war is taking place, that these networks are still firmly in place, are still activated, and that we need to have greater faith in them. these structures are in place globally and nationally that can succeed and are already succeeding. As you say, there is nothing locked in about this agenda, but they are certainly trying to do that. And that we have, you know, 2 years to go. One of the things I hate seeing are bumper stickers that are all over San Francisco anyway, that say, is it 2008 yet? You know, that we cannot hide our head in the sand for two years.
Oh, I know, right.
You know, that there's a lot of damage that they can do, but also restoration that we can do in those 2 years. And the work is already going on, and I'm extremely hopeful about it. That's why, you know, on my website, there are tons of activist groups, research groups that people can connect with. In the book, there's tons of examples of activism. And, you know, I'm very hopeful that we can stop them and turn it around. But most importantly, the first thing we have to do is learn what it is that we're trying to turn around.
Right. Think you might be coming to Portland soon?
I hope so. Let's try and get me there.
Well, hey, that'd be great. Okay, yeah. We've been talking to Antonia Juhas, who has written the book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time, and she has a website, thebushagenda.org. So that's something to browse around and go on from there. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks, Per, very much for having me. I appreciate it.
To do it again.
Excellent.
And this is Per Fagrang. Over and out. Stay tuned for Andrew Giller.
Time is 10 a.m. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Coming up next on